How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? How many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. How many years can a mountain exist before it's washed to the sea? How many years must some people exist before they're allowed to be free? And how many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. How many times can a man look up before he sees the sky? How many ears must one person have before he can hear people cry? And how many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friends, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Oh, the answer, my friends, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Hello, everyone. I'm Chuck Gregory, and this is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we're streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And, you know, this is a listener-supported station, network, whatever. They keep two streams going just about 24/7, and they're great shows, and it's a lot of great people running this station. And like I say, it's listener supported. They depend on listener donations. And I was just taking a look at the little thermometer gizmo on the website, and it said that we're not very close to our goal for the month, and hey, the month is well over two-thirds over. So I really urge all of you and any of you, head on over to freedomslips.com and find a way to make a donation. It's really worth it. It's a good cause. All right. My first guest tonight is Mike Bond. Mike joins me from various places. Sometimes it's Paris, sometimes it's Maine. I'm pretty sure right now he's in Hawaii. In any case, we'll probably find out pretty soon. And I'm going to be adding him into the call. Just a sec here. So let's see, we're gonna add him into the call right about now. So Mike is a novelist, an entrepreneur, a journalist. He's been around, been a lot of.
Hi, Chuck.
Hello, Mike. Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. Good to hear your voice.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, good to hear yours.
Okay.
Yeah, how are you doing? All well?
Yeah, Pretty good. You?
Oh, doing fine. Doing fine. Working and enjoying the rest of the day. It's
Okay.
3 p.m. 3 p.m. where I am, so I'm a little earlier than you.
Yeah, quite a bit earlier, yeah. So that's Hawaii? Okay.
Yeah, that's the way.
I told the listeners I thought that's where you were this month, but I never quite know.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard to know where you're gonna, where I'm not even always sure where I'm gonna be. Something comes up and I gotta go somewhere.
Yeah.
So,
Well, it's
well, what's the subject for today? What do you
Well,
think we ought to
I'm
cover?
pretty open to whatever you would like to address. I mean, whether it's the craziness of this impeachment thing or something else.
Yeah, the impeachment thing, my goodness, we might as well jump in. Everybody else has already jumped in.
Yeah, right.
It's funny as heck. I mean, the only thing I can add to it, Chuck, and you probably have covered this yourself, is that in years ago, after the fall of the wall, the Eastern Wall, the Soviet Union in 89, and for a number of years after that, I worked in the former Soviet Union, both as a energy journalist and also with what had been former Soviet energy companies who were having trouble transitioning to Western energy practice, if you see what I mean. And that's more important in the electricity and the natural gas side than it is in the straight crude side. So I worked there. In fact, I was the chairman of a 28-nation working group that was set up by the European Union to unite the Eastern European Soviet high-voltage electricity transmission system with the West, and also was appointed president of an investment group to upgrade Eastern European gas and oil refineries to Western pollution standards because they were polluting like crazy. So I guess what I'm saying in a long way, and this is, goes into the book I'm writing right now, which is about the oil industry, which is so secretive and so immensely powerful. It's like not noticing the air we breathe. I mean, the oil industry owns us all. They own the planet. And so it makes for very interesting reading. And in part of that, I know gas companies in Ukraine and in Russia quite well. And I can assure you that Vice President Biden's son, forget the guy's name, what's the son's name? I forget.
I
Hunter,
don't.
is that it?
Yeah, that's
Yeah.
right. Yes.
He was totally and absolutely tied up in a very corrupt operation in Ukraine. So whether no matter whose side one's on in this dogfight, where the real corruption was Vice President Biden getting his son put on the board at $50,000 a month. Wouldn't it be nice to get $50,000 a month just for putting your name on a piece of
I
paper?
think I could use that,
You could use that. I bet we all could, And he didn't have to go to meetings. He didn't even speak Ukrainian, which is similar to Russian, almost the same. But anyway, in return for it, Vice President Biden got the Ukrainians to fire the prosecutor that was investigating the gas camp company. So that stinks of corruption, and that's the only thing. And there's a lot of fuss in the press about corruption in Eastern Europe, but some of the corruption in Washington is just as bad in my mind. So that's, I think this whole, go ahead. I'm sorry, Chuck.
I think you're quite right about the corruption in Washington being at least as bad as just about anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, and you and just the fact that our candidates are elected solely on the basis, or almost solely on the basis, of how much money they get in contributions, and then of course, what do they do in return for those contributions? They're not free.
Right.
I mean, the fact that every single representative, congressperson, senator, even at the state level, is basically paid by major groups who have the money. I mean, you and I don't have the money to go out and convince some senator how to vote.
You know? I've often thought that the politicians ought to dress up like the NASCAR drivers with all the all the different companies that they are really representing, blazoned right on their
great idea.
I have to confess, it's not original. I saw a cartoon of that, and I loved it.
Well, it's interesting that back in 1982, before I relocated back to Europe, I lived in Montana with my family and I, and I ran in 1982 in the Democratic primary against an incumbent Democrat. And the reason why I did it is because he was owned by the big logging companies that own a good part of the timberlands, and he wrote a bill late in a meeting in the Senate one night, so it got passed through with nobody looking at it. A bill that allowed logging and road building in wilderness areas, in national wilderness areas. So, you know, finally a whole bunch of people convinced me to run against him. But I didn't only for the 6 weeks prior to the election, still got 37%. But what I called him that the media loved was I called him the senator from Burlington Northern, which was the big logging company in land. So he wasn't the senator from Montana. He was the senator from Burlington Northern. I think the idea that you just pointed out about, like, the NASCAR drivers, you know, I mean, it's you know, back to Biden again. All you just have a big badge that says America's top credit card companies, and you know, they own him.
Yeah.
So it's a crazy bunch. Well, you had mentioned the whole impeachment thing, Chuck. What drift are you getting from it, from listeners and from other people you talk to?
I am actually trying not to watch it. The whole thing is so crazy that I read about it a little bit, but I'm not inclined to, that's not my idea of entertainment.
Good for you, yeah. Yeah, because they want us all there watching, don't they?
They do, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I haven't watched any at all, but I do read, I read several different news sources every day. I try to limit it to a half an hour a day of all news, including science news, which is much more interesting than political news.
Yeah,
so
that's pretty close to my approach, as a matter of fact. I might throw a little sports news in there, but.
Yeah, good for you.
You mentioned some of your history and with these getting the different systems to play together and the people to play mm-hmm. together with the electric company or other utilities. Were most of the differences technical, or were the more serious ones in the mindset, in the political thought?
That's a really, really good question. And I would, thinking back, these people were, by and large, extremely honorable people and very fair-minded and devoted to the welfare of their country and their citizens. So, therefore, the differences were primarily technical, and which means that it's much easier to solve, because you can always use a transformer to step up or step down, you know, power or something like that.
Right.
But I think that what was amazing about the former Soviet Union in the last decade of the 20th century, 1990 to the year 2000, and even way beyond it, even now, is their incredible pro-American and desire to do everything the way we recommend it. I mean, they were so happy to be rid of communism that they figured, well, gee whiz, if the Americans are doing it this way, it must make sense. And then the differences of opinion were mostly in the West. I mean, the French have a different way of running their electrical system than the Americans or the Brits, for instance. Huh. But so it was a very successful venture. What we were very concerned about is if you got too much power down some line from Russia, that it could cook, you know, a factory somewhere in Western Germany. And, when I say cook, I mean just burn out the electrical systems. And so it was an extremely successful project, and I learned working with a lot of Russians that they are just such wonderful people. They're so much fun, and they have a marvelous humorous side, as well as being very diligent, hardworking, and honorable people. I love working with the Russians. I've been there many times, all over the country. So it's a place I do recommend. You know, if one has kind of spent all one's time in one's native country, and you got a chance to go to two or three countries elsewhere in the world, I would certainly recommend, first of all, France, just because it's the most varied place on earth, and then probably Russia, and it would be number two because it's so enormous.
Really? Yeah, oh, I know.
Well, it goes on forever. 11 times off. Yeah.
Wow.
So
11 times.
And the Russians are extremely pro-American even now, so it's a nice place to visit. And a lot of them speak English, so that's fun too.
Yeah, that would help, since probably the majority of us in the United States don't speak anything other than English, at least not very well.
Because we have the world's dominant culture, so we really don't have to.
Right.
And also, because we have the world's dominant culture, there's not a huge education drive to get our young people to learn multiple languages, you know.
Right.
So.
Right.
In Holland, and then – go ahead. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, I was fortunate quite a few years ago when I was in school to have taken 5 years of Latin and a couple of years of Russian. But I think that was very unusual, and I can't say that I was ever any good at Russian. I could count, and I could tell people I was a stupid fool because my teacher used to tell me that all the time, a glupy durak.
By saying it, you prove you're not. But anyway,
yeah.
Well, you, I bet if you went back, if you went there, you'd find that it would come back very fast. And boy, the Russians love people who try to speak their language. So you would certainly get a positive response. It's it's a fascinating place. But the other thing, I mean, Moscow itself, for instance, is like it's like 10 Parises all stuck together side by side. It's enormous.
Wow.
And, and so much of the architecture is beautiful. And, getting from one place to Russia, in Russia to another, on the train, it can take a week, on a fast train.
So
anyway.
Well, this is going to be a very interesting year, I think, with, we've got impeachment, then we've got, elections, primaries, and then the actual elections in the fall. It's going to be a pretty crazy year, I think.
I think so, too, and I think when I think in the past, of how worried about some of the stuff I used to get and all of the time I spent. What a waste of time. I mean, the important things in life, as you and I talked about last month, are the people you love, your friends, doing something that's worthwhile, that makes a better world. As you talk about frequently in the Great American Dream. Kind of one of the visions, as I understand it. And so these are the things that are important, because what goes on in Washington is like a clown show when it's there to distract us. And it's kind of like watching a bad comedy. Yeah, I take to heart what you said about being careful not to watch too much of it.
Okay. Well, thank you for being with me once again in this new year, and I look forward to visiting with you again next month, wherever you may be.
Sounds great to me, Chuck.
Okay. I think there's about a minute left if you would like to plug your latest book or anything like that.
Well, I could briefly. All my books are on sale in the ebook version at Amazon for 99 cents. It's the best way to reach out at a minimal price and contact as many people as possible. Many libraries have them also, but my latest book is Goodbye Paris, which is a thriller based on a manhunt for terrorists in Paris before they blow up the Eiffel Tower. And it's based on fact and a lot of experience.
It's a very good one, too. I enjoyed that one a lot. And all right. Well, thanks. Thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you.
And talk to you next month.
Yeah, thank you for the invite onto the show, and my best wishes to everyone out there, and let's hope 2020 turns out to be kind of cool.
Yeah.
All right. Take care.
Okay.
So
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, listeners, it's time now for the station break. Thank you for being here with me on the New American Dream Radio Show. Talk to you in a few minutes. Well, hello again, everyone. Once again, this is Chuck Gregory, the New American Dream Radio Show. And our next guest of the evening is Philip Ferrugio. Philip gets the second segment on each show. And we call this part of the show, It's the Empire, Stupid. So we're going to call Phil right about now. And see if we can't get him added in here.
evening.
Well, hello, Philip.
Hello, Chuck. How are you, Chuck? Chuck,
okay.
I'm going to read something that I wrote. It's interesting. I wrote this, 9 years ago. Now, listen to this.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Sheep always seem to lose their wool. And the quote is, "None are more hopelessly enslaved than those who falsely believe they are free." That was said by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Now, September 11th, our nation had floundered. This is, don't forget, 2011 I wrote this. September 11th, around the corner, our nation flounders in an economic and psychological depression. Are you aware that our defense budget, the one we know about, not the extra black budget, grew from $316 billion in 2001 to $708 billion in 2011. Both houses of this controlled Congress and our controlled presidents overwhelmingly supported it. You see, it matters not which of the two-party con job wins office or if this new Tea Party joke gets its people elected. The bottom line, we are now and have been for decades not a democratic republic. Rather, a military-industrial empire that even Cold Warrior Eisenhower warned us about in January 1961. Of course, Ike and all of our presidents have been chosen by this College of Corporations for centuries, relying upon the quiet obedience of the sheep, especially during the election cycle. Now, on Monday, August 29th, this is 2011, USA Today's money section, there was an article that should have been blasted throughout the media. It said, "Banks start offering payday loans." Of course, the banks call them direct deposit loans. Here's how it works. The bank customer has a checking account where he or she has either a pension, a payroll, or a government, like Social Security, SSI check, directly deposited. When the customer needs money ASAP, the bank offers a loan, whereupon they charge $10 interest on every $100 borrowed. To guarantee repayment, the money is taken out of the next direct deposit. Sounds reasonable, just like the corner loan sharks in my Brooklyn neighborhood said when they got 6 for $5 on short-term loans. Consumer watchdog groups say that this new banking scheme amounts to a 300% annualized interest rate. Where was Mr. Obama when all this was being reported? Oh, he was at a fundraiser for his 2012 campaign hosted by Goldman Sachs. Well, why not? After all, the rich bankers could afford the $30,000 a head to break bread with the president, which is more than many of the 2008 Obama voters earned in 1 year, if they still had a job. Tell me, when in the hell are the good Americans out there going to say enough is enough? Now look at your cable or your satellite television bill. Look how much you are paying now compared to what you paid 10 years ago in 2001. Look at the gasoline prices now compared to 10 years ago. The food prices, banking fees charged. It seems that the 95% of us are being told to bear the burden of the crimes and misdemeanors of the fat cats. Where is the outrage? Where is the protest? How about health care or lack of? Most of us cannot afford to get the needed health care or dental care we require. Did this writer, and many he knows and sees every day, has spaces in his mouth where once lived a tooth? Why? Well, do the math. It takes around $1,000 for a root canal and another $1,000 for a crown, or just $200 to have it pulled. Forget about the choice to have implants put in. They cost about $5,000 a tooth. Do you think our Congress or Mr. Obama needs to worry about such things? Factor out the fools who think the Tea Party is about consumer rights when it is the rich who are behind the whole movement. Finally, we come to this fair tax movement to take the place of the income tax. Don't they get it? The fair tax is nothing more than a sales tax. Instead of the current and regressive 5 to 10% sales tax, these jokers want to saddle Americans with a 20-plus percent fair tax, a.k.a. sales tax. How many toaster ovens or pair of shoes or dresses can a millionaire need compared to that of the hundreds of millions of us working stiffs or the unemployed who wind up buying all those things? Check out how much you pay in taxes each month you fill up your gas tank, each time you fill up your gas tank. If that is not a regressive tax, then what is? Many of us need a car to get to work or school or to the doctor, as mass transit funding has continually been cut for decades. Yet, these fair tax fools don't insist on the real remedy to our tax needs, surtax the millionaires. Yes, there were over 16 million millionaire households in America in 2007. Let's issue a 50% flat tax on all income over $1 million. No accountant's pencil, no nothing, no deductions. After all, Henry Paulson, when he left Goldman Sachs in 2006 to become Bush Jr.'s Treasury Secretary, he earned $500 million in compensation that year. Yeah, the guy trusted with the trust of we saps and suckers cut that deal to bail out his friends on Wall Street with our tax money. Do you think Henry would not be able to survive on $250 million instead of $500 million? Come on, fellow sheep, wake up. Get off your duffs and raise some hell. Stop supporting this two-party scam. Stop allowing your hard-earned income and savings to go to the empire instead of your families. Speak up, speak out. The masters of the manor hate it when the rabble gets organized and yells outside their door. Change and hope are out there, if you really want it. Thank you. Hello?
If only we really did want it.
Did you fall asleep while I was telling that?
I put my mic on mute, and I forgot to turn it back up when I started talking back to you.
I thought maybe you fell asleep, Chuck.
I wouldn't do that to you.
That's
no,
okay.
No. Here I was trying to say, okay, like I say, if only we really did want change and would try to make it happen. Because the majority of Americans, it seems, really would just kind of prefer to keep on doing whatever it is they're doing and ignore everything else.
But the reason for all that is that the media is so well controlled, and as well as the politicians, that the average person, maybe not you and I, because I get my information from the alternative media, but I would say the majority of American people don't. They get their information from the mainstream media, you know, whether they're in the television, the radio, or the newspapers, and they are giving them a con job. What I just read to everybody.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's. You know, it's just, it's sad because, you know, when I ask people, I say, what percentage of your tax money do you think goes for, you know, towards military spending? Nobody would ever come up with 50%.
Yeah.
Half. Nobody.
It's actually, I think, closer to 60, but.
Yeah, it is. It is. Well, you have the black budget, too. All the black budgets, which our tax money goes to, but we don't even know about.
Yeah.
But, Chuck, the thing is that. Why aren't people outraged?
Well, they think it's protecting them.
Yes, exactly.
They've swallowed
right.
The Kool-Aid.
Yes. They think that it is defending us.
Yeah.
And, you know, with all the money in the world, Chuck, all the money in the world, all the security you want to try to get, after what we did to the Iranian, you know, assassinating that general, I mean, you know, let's just hope and pray, because you and I are men of peace. So let's just hope and pray that there isn't a really bad blowback within our own country. But, you know, if that was to happen, unfortunately, all the money, you know, in the world isn't going to, you know, defend, is keep us secure from what people could do. You know how it is. I mean, it's the way it's always been. You know, things are done in the shadows, or sometimes they're done right in the open. That's why they have those people that you know, are suicide bombers in, you know, in right. different parts of the world. I mean, you can't stop that, you know. Well, the only way it can be stopped, I believe, is if we didn't incite the people who are doing those crazy, you know, acts,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
If we didn't incite them with what, you know, we've been doing to them. So it's a...
Right.
Oh, it's just a sad story. It really is.
If we tried, you know, the golden rule, you know, hey, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, you know?
Yeah.
But no, we... Oh, let's just go push everybody around. Let's, you know, let's... This guy isn't enough on our corporate side. Let's get rid of him and put in somebody else. How about this one over here?
Yeah.
Let's do this. Let's topple him. You know, you do that all over the world, and, you know, after a while, people don't like it.
Well, that's the, you know, I was reading a piece today on one of the websites I read, and they were talking about the late 1880s when they had a conference in Europe, and all these major countries, Germany, the U.S., I think the U.S. was there too, the English, the French, you know, all the major countries, they were talking about how to divide up Africa.
Yeah.
You know? No, really. They were actually talking about, like, you know, who's going into what countries and who's going to control Tunisia, who's controlling Egypt, who's controlling Namibia, whatever, East Africa, West Africa, South Africa.
Right.
And it was all these European countries and the U.S. that they were in. They were just talking about Africa as if it was just a platter at some buffet. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, this is real. This is not, I'm not making this up.
I know.
You know?
I know.
And it's so sad. It's so darn sad because it hasn't stopped. It just continues. I mean, look at Latin America. Look at South America. Look what happened with all these European countries going into South America, you know, many, many moons ago, many you know, centuries ago. And just, you know, just colonizing all these countries. As if the people there were what? Were they sheep? You know what I mean? Were they? You know? And it's terrible, Chuck. I mean, look what they did to the American Indians here.
I was just gonna say, you know, it's not just South America. What about North America? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, the French and Indian War. The British and the French were fighting over, you know, over the over colonial America. You know, who's going to control it? I mean, it never stopped. It never stopped. And it's like, I think the public over the time has just become numb. You know what I'm saying? It's like if you read Orwell's, you know, 1984.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I recommend everybody who's listening to this now. If you read it before, I read it, you read it. But go get a copy again. And read the book again, because it's interesting, you know, to see to see exactly what a totalitarian state looks like and how close we are here becoming to that.
Yeah.
But they're so shrewd, Chuck, because they give us the means to be consumers, you know?
Of course. Well, hey,
right.
That's so, what they... Yeah.
Yeah,
we're good little consumers.
Yeah, I mean, we're good little consumers, and but yet it's a totalitarian state, you know, because I mean, look what they're doing now. I mean, with the internet. I mean, I have so many complaints by people I know. I don't know if you found this out, but you know, people go to Google to look something up, and they have ways of, like, not allowing you to see things that a year ago you would have came up on the Google. You know, they kind of censor some information that people can't even get.
Exactly.
Right? You can't even get it.
You know, some of that is done, in Google, you know, with them, you know, hiding things. But a lot of it is that the actual websites have been taken down. You know, the actual places that were providing those search results are no more.
Are no more.
Case
and how
in
about
point,
the sites? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the sites
go
are
ahead.
Gone. A case in point, my former co-host used to run a magazine called Penn Magazine. And we had a website, and it was really interesting, but due to some, you know, legal troubles that he had last year, he had me take down all of the issues of his magazine. And we just kept up a front page, you know, with a Sophie Scholl quote on it. And then in this last week, even that got hacked. And I ended up just, you know, I got it back to working. I took a screenshot of the front page. I got rid of everything else and just, you know, throw that up. If somebody goes to penmagazine.us, then they will see just that image and nothing else. Because,
you know,
I can't, you know, keep fixing it after it gets hacked.
You know, remember, Greenville Post, which is a site that I write for, Greenville Post has been attacked for the last year now, and it's so bad that certain writers like myself, I found out through an intermediary, certain writers can't even get our work to him. We can't even get our work to the site to even submit it. I've had to get people copy and paste my work and send it, you know, through their email. Seriously. Mm-hmm. I mean, because I can't even contact them, but my email, it's not going through, and they can't contact me by email. It's ridiculous. I'm being serious now. So this is real, what's happening, and that's what happens under a totalitarian state.
Yep.
Maybe it's a little more subtle now, but it is happening, and it's very sad, and, you know, really, this whole thing with this whole, you know, Democratic Party, you know, primary season, I mean, you know, I changed my affiliation from independent from Green Party to Democrat only because I want to vote for Sanders in the Florida primary. And my brother did that in California. And my brother is even farther left than I am, okay?
Uh-huh.
And he said, too, that he said he just can't believe what the Democratic Party is doing to Sanders.
Yeah.
You know, they're sabotaging his whole campaign through the media, through CNN.
Yeah.
If anybody saw what happened in that last debate, you know.
Yeah. And of course, that's exactly what they did last time. And it came back and bit him in, behind because, they ended up with the candidate.
Yeah, from the research that I've been, the research that I was told and given by the people I know in California, I mean, and my brother lives out there, I mean, they swear that Sanders won that primary and they gave it to her, to Clinton.
Uh-huh.
That there was a lot of dirty tricks on. And you know what happened in the 2000, 2004 elections, nationwide, and Florida for Bush in 2000 and Ohio Bush in 2004.
Uh-huh.
They definitely, in my opinion, from what I've read of all the researchers and the muckrakers, they most likely cheated in Florida and in Ohio.
Yeah.
In those two elections and gave the election to Bush. Both times he would have lost. Okay. Matter of fact, on election night 2004, they had what's his name? The guy Morris. Who used to be Clinton's pollster, Dick Morris. Yeah, and then he became more of a right-winger after that. But anyway, in 2004, he was on one of the network election return shows. He was the analyst. He was the analyst that sat with the guy, you know, with the host. And during the night, it comes across that Kerry was way ahead in all the exit polls in Ohio. Hi. And Morris says, he said, exit polling is the most accurate of all the polling. He said, if that's the case, he said, Kerry's going to take Ohio. Uh-huh. And then a couple hours later, it came out that Bush took Ohio. And Morris on the air said, something's fishy. Yeah. Something's rotten over here.
Something
he goes,
he actually right
said
here.
That. Yeah. Yeah, he said, there's something is not right here. Something's going on here. Uh-huh. On the air, he said that. So, you know, it was kind of obvious to people who understand what's going on that votes were being switched, flipped on the machines. And anyway, it's a sad story. It really is.
It is.
And I don't know what's going to happen in this next election. If Sanders doesn't get the nomination, you know, I'll vote for the Democrat, which I don't usually do, but I'll vote for the Democrats across the board because this white supremacist, neo-fascist movement is too powerful and it's scary.
Yeah.
You know, and we got to do something to stop it. And let me just tell people listening, I know it's getting late, but in 1932 in Germany, if the Social Democrats and the Communist parties would have joined together, if they would have formed a coalition, the Nazis would have not won the majority of seats in that election. And I don't know what would have happened to the whole Nazi movement under Hitler. It's a very strong possibility that they would have been thwarted at that time, and they would have not legitimately had the power that they got.
Uh-huh.
If the Social Democrats and the Communist Party, who were the two most popular parties at that time, okay, in a multi-party system.
Right.
If they would have gotten together, formed a coalition, the Nazis would have not taken over the Reichstag, and everything might have changed. So, you know, these are things that sometimes, I hate to say it, but sometimes you have to reach some sort of compromises when you're facing an enemy that is very frightening, you know?
Compromise, compromise is not evil. Compromise is actually it can be a very, very good thing, because people, when they come to a compromise, they have found the things that they have in common.
Right.
And with a little bit of the things that they can live with.
Well, they sacrifice
and they
a
put
lot
it together.
In order to get a little, yeah. They sacrifice a lot, but they get something that is better than they did than what they had.
Yeah. They might not be sacrificing a lot. They might just be sacrificing a little.
That's why, Chuck, in this coming election, again, you have to understand something. I have no love for the Democrats, okay? Of course, I have the disdain for the Republicans, but I have no love for the Democrats because of what I've written about for many years.
Yeah.
Right? But having said that, when you're facing an era that we're in right now, which is really frightening, Chuck, this right-wing neo-fascist anyway. You don't want to say neo-Nazi. A neo-fascist movement in this country, a mindset that is scary. Did you see the Larry David show recently?
No.
You know, Curb Your Enthusiasm?
I don't really watch TV.
Well, there was a segment where he's trying to get rid of a guy who's a pain in the neck. So he meets him, he tells him to meet him at a restaurant, and he knows the guy hates Trump. So he puts on a red Make America Great Again, the baseball cap, in the restaurant. And the guy goes and sees him. And the guy's, oh, I got to go. I'm sorry. I can't have lunch with you. But then, wait. So then Larry, and then all the people in the restaurant are all looking at Larry David like, because it's, Democrats, L.A., all that stuff. So then he goes in his car. He's driving. He doesn't have the hat on. He's driving his car. And some motorcycle guy is getting mad at him. He thinks he cut him off. And the guy pulls alongside, a big, you know, muscle guy in a motorcycle. And he's like yelling at Larry David. So Larry David puts the hat on. And the guy looks at him and he goes, "Okay, pal, go ahead. It's okay. It's okay."
Wow.
"Go ahead, pal. It's okay, man." That was so funny.
Well,
that was
that's
great.
Pretty strange. All right. Yeah, on that note, yeah. Phil, we've got to cut it short. Thank you very much, for being here with me every week, and I look forward to talking again next time.
Take care, buddy. Bye bye.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Come back with us after the station break. Well, hello, everyone. Welcome back to the New American Dream Radio Show. Our next guest of the evening is Michael Annis. Michael joins us each month from Denver. I got to meet him in person a couple months back, back around Thanksgiving. And anyway, we're gonna have Michael on momentarily as soon as I manage to call him here. And here we go.
Hello.
Well, hello, Michael. It's Chuck Gregory, the New American Dream Radio Show. Welcome.
Well, hi, Chuck. It's good to be back on the New American Dream. I have a special treat tonight. Denver has a very extensive literary community with, I would say we are rich with high-quality writers, people who I think are really seeking to make a difference. Tonight, I am going to introduce to the New American Dream audience one of our writing elders. His name is Seth. He's one of Denver's finest performance artists, collaborated with musicians, actors, dancers, and fellow poets for over 30 years. He's been a member of Open Rangers. These are groups, artistic groups, Jafrica, and is currently a member of Art Compost and the Word Mechanics. He's a writer of poetry, including a poetic memoir, A Black Odyssey, and fiction, including a forthcoming novel, The Perfect Stranger. He's coordinated and produced the Denver Poetry Rodeo, in which I have participated several times for the last 10 years, and has hosted the Jam Before the Slam at Denver's Mercury Cafe for 20 years. He's been a performing poet in my productions of 100,000 Poets for Change when I was coordinating those events here in Denver. And he has also worked with me in a performance of Wolves at the Mall, my piece, my poetitation, as I call them, with my ghost ship Rats. So, Chuck, I present to you and the New American Dream, Seth.
Hello there, Chuck. Thank you for having me on.
Well, I'm glad to have you. Welcome.
Thank you. Oh, well, I thought I would read a section of my, Michael has mentioned it, my poetic memoir. It's called The Black Odyssey, and it is arranged to follow the story of Homer's Odyssey, but it sort of captures my life and my journey. And one of the things that I've been known for is taking different poems and rearranging them in such a way as to make new narratives out of them, and that's exactly what I have done in my book. I've arranged them so that several poems are in a given chapter, and when read together, they're a new poem. Shall I start off reading one?
Yes, please do.
All right. Well, as I mentioned, this is three poems together to seem like they're one. It's called One More Strange Island. somewhere between mud and heaven, this forgetting, this never knowing the known, this denying what like bone permeates our imperviousness to we. Somewhere between dirt and stratosphere, the right to take away what cannot be taken, except on pain of inflicting pain, which always returns to haunt, to hang somewhere between rock and ruin. Somewhere between flesh that walks and the firefly's bright remark, cocktail in one hand, cigarette in the ashtray, comes, almost always arrives, the red cries of conflicts, burnt meats, the boil on the battlefield, the orator on the scaffold, the noose that, despite the wisdom of talk shows, fails to discriminate between the notary and public stamp of good and certifiable evil. Somewhere between the idiot savant and the sycophant idiocy is the remembering that only remembers to forget. They have declared war, these towers that rise above you. They have hotwired your car, tapped your phone, targeted children and ignorant bystanders, for terrorizing ignorance is their only means of getting at you. They orange your waters, turn bloody your air, disguise themselves as telephone poles, spitting electric death rays up your spinal cord in hopes of striking a sympathetic vibration. Can they be satisfied, crushed into submission, placated with better television? These towers have hearts of chiseled stone, eyes of tinted glass, backbone of U.S.-grade mining disaster steel. Their elevators have gone on strike. Revolving doors are revolting. Restrooms are for paying customers only. Even the janitor's mop is poised and loaded. You had best use the emergency exit. It's gonna be a long, lonely limousine ride now that the caviar is radioactive, now that the sniper has changed its tune, now that the ideals with which you have skinned the natives have rolled on their bellies, cocked their pistons, and aimed their angry gods at you. Dear Osama, Sitting Bull, Geronimo, and Red Cloud greet you. We have heard about the travesty and read with great sympathy your complaint, but be advised, in history, the lies are true. Mirror, mirror, on the wall, who's the fairest of them all? Snow White, with her seven dwarves. We, too, were once terrorists, scourge to civilization, threat to their freedom. Like your Palestinian, removed from the land of our ancestors as if our rights, our desperation, our starving and slaughtered children did not exist. He holds these truths to be self-evident, that all men, except those in the way, are equal. Like you, we evaded their cavalry, attacked instead white picket fences and SUVs parked in the two-door garages where our teepees used to be, while out in the yard their broken treaties flapped in the wind. And for that, we were the barbarians, made to crawl on our wounded knees, wrapped in blankets of smallpox, herded like our buffalo to near extinction. And so we feel compelled to warn you, Osama, that in history, even the lies are true. Mirror, mirror, on the wall, who's the fairest of them all? Armed with Manifest Destiny and his good neighbor policy, spreading goodwill and good cheer, that new improved laundry detergent, guaranteed to take the dinge out of indigenous, guaranteed to whitewash any dictator's bloody jeans. By the way, Osama, Che Guevara sends his greetings. He holds these truths to be self-evident, that the death of a million Indians or a billion Arabs can never measure up to the comfy lives of even just a few cozy, all-consuming Americans. And you, Osama, you slew more than 3,000. That makes you evil. And all her bombs, incursions, subterfuge, preemptive strikes, waterboardings, assassinations, and drone attacks. Good. Mirror, mirror on the wall. Perhaps you thought in lashing back that you might reveal to her her sin, but Snow White has slept with 1,000 dogs and still remains a virgin. Read her history books. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all? Snow White, pure as the driven snow, her children playing cowboys and Indians. Pure as the driven snow she will bury you in, Osama, because in his story, even the lie are true. And that's it, Chuck.
Wow, that was very powerful.
Thank you.
You read well and you had a lot to say.
Chuck?
Tell me more about this, the format of the book. You said something about, you know, three poems to make a chapter. Can you go into that a little more?
What I did is I've actually stopped writing poetry so I could focus on fiction, and I decided to take the poems that I had and do a collection of them. And so I arranged them to follow the Odyssey. It starts with, invocation to the gods for inspiration. And then follows. If you know the Odyssey, it starts with Telemachus searching for his father. So my book has a chapter about Telemachus. And what I've done is, although the poems are separate, there are 67 of them, I arranged them in 16 chapters so that each chapter is a poem within itself. The poems can be put together and read. I do not put the titles in between them, so they're to be read as one poem.
Right.
So you've got 16 chapters, and then, of course, the entire collection is one entire poem following my journey, which parallels that of Odysseus in the Odyssey.
Okay. Is this a work in progress? It's not available yet?
Oh, it's done, yeah.
Oh, it is done. Well, please tell the listeners where to find it.
Well, you can find it in Amazon. I should mention that I go by one name. It is Seth, and I spell it in capital letters. So you can go to Amazon and look up Seth, and the title, as I said, is A Black Odyssey.
Okay. Well, very good. That was just an amazing poem, and I do hope to hear more from you, at other times.
Well, I would love to come back on.
Okay. So, Michael, what are you up to?
Well, I don't know how much time we actually have left.
Well, I think we have about 10 minutes.
Okay, I think I can get this. Yeah, I think I can get this done. So tonight,
I'm really happy to have brought Seth to the New American Dream.
Yes,
so
thank
that
you for
was
that.
Definitely, mm-hmm. even if there's a shortage of time, it's okay. I can get through this. Tonight, I want to bring tribute to one of what I consider one of the great American poets of the 1950s and 60s, and known as a member of the Beat Generation that included Burroughs and Carso and Ginsberg and Kerouac and so forth. She is not as well known, but she should be. Her name was Lenora Kandel. Now I'm going to read a short intro to her work from Barry Miles' anthology Beat Collection as follows. Lenora Kandel, born in New York City in 1932 of Turkish and Russian ancestry. Her parents moved within a year to Los Angeles, where her father was a screenwriter. She first met the Beats when she went to San Francisco for a weekend, met Lou Welch, and ended up going to Big Sur with Jack Kerouac. He named her Ramona Schwartz in Big Sur and wrote that she was, in quotes, intelligent, well-read, writes poetry, is a Zen student, and knows everything. She remained in San Francisco, living for a time with Lou Welch and continuing her Zen studies. The poem included here comes from her Beat period rather than her later, more psychedelic material. She is best known for The Love Book, published in 1965, and the subject of a court case for obscenity. She defended her erotic poems before the judge, saying they expressed her, in quotes, belief that sexual acts between loving persons are religious acts. And in fact, she called her own style and substance of writing holy erotica. That really doesn't convey the magnitude of power, the brilliance of her writing, nor does it seek to. For the New American Dream audience, I describe her writing thus. She expands the metaphor out into an all-encompassing cloud of comprehension, ablaze with lightning of revolutionary consciousness. And now Lenore Kandel's First They Slaughtered the Angels. First they slaughtered the angels, tying their thin white legs with wire cords and opening their silk throats with icy knives. They died fluttering their wings like chickens, and their immortal blood wet the burning earth. We watched from underground, from the gravestones, the crypts, chewing our bony fingers and shivering in our piss-stained winding sheets. The seraphs and the cherubim are gone. They have eaten them and cracked their bones for marrow. They have wiped their asses on angel feathers, and now they walk the rubbled streets with eyes like fire pits. Two, who finked on the angels? Who stole the Holy Grail and hocked it for a jug of wine? Who fucked up Gabriel's golden horn? Was it an inside job? Who barbecued the Lamb of God? Who flushed St. Peter's keys down the mouth of a North Beach toilet? Who raped St. Mary with a plastic dildo stamped with the good housekeeping seal of approval? Was it an outside job? Where are our weapons? Where are our bludgeons, our flamethrowers, our poison gas, our hand grenades? We fumble for our guns and our knees sprout credit cards. We vomit canceled checks, standing spread-legged with open sphincters, weeping soap suds from our radioactive eyes, and screaming for the ultimate rifle, the messianic cannon, the Paschal bomb. The bellies of women split open and children rip their way out with bayonets, spitting blood in the eyes of blind midwives before impaling themselves on their own swords. The penises of men are become blue steel machine guns. They ejaculate bullets. They spread death as an orgasm. Lovers roll in the bushes, tearing at each other's genitals with iron fingernails. Fresh blood is served at health food bars in germ-free paper cups, gulped down by syphilitic club women in papier-mâché masks, each one the same hand-painted face of Hamlet's mother at the age of 10. We watch from underground, our eyes like periscopes, flinging our fingers to the dogs for candy bars in an effort to still their barking, in an effort to keep the peace, in an effort to make friends and influence people. Three, we have
collapsed our collapsible bomb shelters. We have folded our folding life rafts. And at the count of 12, they have all disintegrated into piles of rat shit, nourishing the growth of poison flowers and Venus pitcher plants. We huddle underground, hugging our porous chests with mildewed arms, listening to the slow blood drip from our severed veins, lifting the tops of our zippered skulls to ventilate our brains. They have murdered our angels. We have sold our bodies and our hours to the curious. We have paid off our childhood in dishwashers and Milltown and rubbed salt upon our bleeding nerves in the course of searching, and they have shit upon the open mouth of God. They have hung the saints in straitjackets, and they have tranquilized the prophets. They have denied both Christ and Koch, and diagnosed Buddha as catatonic, emasculated the priests and the holy men, and censored even the words of love. Lobotomy for every man, and they have nominated a eunuch for president. Lobotomy for the housewife, lobotomy for the businessman, lobotomy for the nursery schools, and they have murdered the angels. 4. Now in the alleyways, the androgynes gather swinging their leper's bells like censers as they prepare the ritual rape of God. The grease that shines their lips is the fat of angels. The blood that cakes their claws is the blood of angels. They are gathering in the streets and playing dice with angels' eyes. They are casting the last lots of Armageddon. Now in the aftermath of morning, we are rolling away the stones from underground, from the caves. We have widened our peyote-visioned eyes and rinsed our mouths with last night's wine. We have caulked the holes in our arms with dust and flung libations at each other's feet. And we shall enter into the streets and walk among them and do battle, holding our lean and empty hands upraised. We shall pass among the strangers of the world like a bitter wind. And our blood will melt iron, and our breath will melt steel. We shall stare face to face with naked eyes, and our tears will make earthquakes, and our wailing will cause mountains to rise and the sun to halt. They shall murder no more angels, not even us.
Wow. Thank you, Michael.
It's always good to be here.
Ah. And you got it done in time.
I guess I did.
Yeah.
And with
with time to spare, and that was really very, very good. I'd like to let our listeners know that Michael will be joining me again next week. This is at 5 Thursday month, so we have a kind of a special show on the 5th Thursday, anytime that one comes along. And this one is going to be focused on topics related to prisons. And Michael has agreed to do one of the segments. The show will be opening with Canon Patero Sabuni, who was a chaplain at Sing Sing for about 20 years, and it's going to be a pretty interesting show. I haven't quite got all the rest of the lineup together yet, but I certainly appreciate you agreeing to join me for that, Michael.
Oh, I wouldn't miss it, Chuck. I love it. Love okay. Doing the New American Dream.
All right.
I want to mention before we go, before the music comes on, the death march for this segment, that yes, in this first quarter of 2020,
My comprehensive collection of poetry, poetitations, and fiction, and semi-fiction, and whatever, Howling at the End of the World, will be coming out. So
right.
I will get more details when I get those details from my publisher.
Okay. Well, thank you for mentioning that. And look forward to seeing that. Okay, well, thanks again for being with me, and you always bring such interesting people with you, and I appreciate that.
All I know in Denver are interesting people.
All right.
I avoid the other ones.
Okay, okay. Okay.
Okay.
All right, listeners.
Thank you so much,
thank
Chuck.
Thank you for joining us, and we will be back for one more segment of the New American Dream Radio Show right after the station break.
Cool, man. You did great. Okay. Fabulous poem, by the way.
Thanks.
Yeah. Great poem.
It was actually three strung together.
That's okay.
Yeah, I know.
Welcome back, everyone. This is the final segment of the New American Dream Radio Show. And at this time, I'm going to play a conversation I had earlier with Frank Cordero of the Des Moines Catholic Worker. So here we go. Frank Cordero.
Yo, Chuck.
Well, hello, Frank.
Hi. Hi. You know, I've been trying to think, you know, you're calling. I should have something to talk about. and I'm for want of speaking. I can talk about, the constant update. It's like you have a low-grade headache all the time. This is the Jess and Ruby kind of thing. You know, you can't go on without that being resolved. What's the next thing, the next shoe to fall? So that's a constant in living with that for me. I can only imagine what it is for Jess and Ruby, and yeah. I can, because I've been close to the system to know. So that's just the constant, just saying that. The other thing that I'm experiencing as a constant, but this is something I think is we're all sharing as Americans right now. It's this impeachment phase of the Donald Trump presidency.
Yeah.
It's a kind of like overwhelming, and at the same time, talking to a few people. You know, the Democrats have been laying out a great case about what, I mean, I know I've sat in lots of trials and I just hate the way in which you have to bring in evidence, you know, the kind
right.
of boring way.
Right.
And they're doing about as good as they could, given what they're up to do. But it just reminds me that evidential stuff is boring. Always has been. So just speaking to that, and then at the same time, you know, you just, You can't. It's a what's going on is like we're all in this kind of surprise. Nothing can get crazier, and it gets crazier. You know, I mean, who the hell knew this Lev Perez or whatever, the guy who's working with Giuliani? I mean, these are characters out of cartoon books, and Giuliani is just like, I mean. I would see him more like the Joker in this whole scene. He's really gone off the deep edge. I mean, he's even crazier than Trump. I mean, that. And then, of course, they've got their Darth Vader in the Attorney General. Scary guy. All of these things are just kind of like great girth for the national plot and narrative that's being played out in this national soap opera that's going on. Just which belies, I must say, the inevitable way in which our empire continues to play out in the globe, and our ill-fated ways are playing out on the planet. And the world is more and more seeing us as the problem, the ostracized, crazy Americans. We will have lived in our generation a lifetime in which the whatever was credible after World War II, which is very questionable, has been completely squandered, And it's not all that clear that the world is better off, that the Allies won, given where we have brought the planet and the species post-World War II. In all seriousness, it's a... It's a showstopper, and no one seems to be able to grasp speaking to it in an adequate and honest and forthright way. And none of the traditional moral setters, institutional-wise, in this country are completely abdicated their responsibilities. I'm talking about the what goes for education, what goes for religious moral stuff. These are big things, church and schools. And these are all these schools, these rhetoric schools, these schools that teach any kind of moral teachings, these alleged Catholic theology schools living off the fat of Wall Street and not really addressing the sin in their midst and blessing the wealth and the wars and the empire. It's irrefutable that that's what's going on. And it's, what's difficult is to people just don't want to say that, don't want to buy that.
Right.
And then when you say, let's just, you know, then they're just saying you're just being like the Republicans. Or you're doing, I'm in arguments with people on Facebook, and they can't believe someone could have an argument against Trump that's without being, that must be a Democrat. I mean, they can, or they just call you a socialist, like that means anything.
Oh my goodness!
So, but this is the level of discourse, my problem is that I have a similar rhetorical kind of engagement, let's say, as the current partisan hacks. However, I do it from a position of weakness, from a street corner and a soup kitchen, in a black and white, where I can speak to this in a black and white terms.
Right.
Wholeheartedly, full-throatedly, but carry no weight, and the consequences always come back on me. That's entirely different than the what's going on here in the TV world and the landscapes that we see in the media world and people who buy commercial time, all of them. Public speech is really commercial speech, and lots of always, and it's a so it's a of course, you know, sooner or later Frank gets to the pity pot, poor me, you know. It's really a bitch, you know, to have these kind of leaderships who are completely misrepresenting the, I mean, their rhetoric is combatant, me or nobody else, black and white, which is, you know, that should be reserved to people who go to the Jordan and yell and scream, repent, not for people who are running Wall Street and government.
Exactly.
So, again, it's really hard to find my niche and my voice in this culture. But I'm following a pattern of unlistened to prophets, which when you're living in a first world basically means you do a demonstration and you look and see if you got any press, and then you try to improve your leaflet the next time.
Yeah.
There's no risk. No one's shooting us and killing us in the streets. And that's happening a lot.
It is.
For people who do far less than what you and I do, Chuck.
Huh.
Just saying.
It is that.
And so I write these people and I say, look, one guy who's really nice guy, he's been in the peace movement, and he says, you know, if you talk in such ways, you shut off all conversations, and, you know, you put yourself in a silo. I mean, you only talk to people who agree with you. And then I run it back. You know, I don't know if I would call it a silo. I would call it personalism. And I said, then I says, what I do is, you know, I live and work, a shelter doing the works of mercy, and I try to speak truth. And I'm a personalist to everyone I see. And that's my plan. Why water that down, for saying things that are just not helping us get graveling on to the truth of where we're at?
Right.
I'm at a loss. Yeah.
But you still have to listen, you know, to the people that are saying the opposite of what you really know to be true. Find out where they're coming from and try to find some way to reach them.
I can find common ground with both sides of the political things.
Yep.
I mean, the discontent that the Republicans had with Hillary is valid, and the whole damn person valid. What they did is they picked the wrong human being for one. And if they can be fooled by a billionaire, they still don't understand what's going on.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hope that filled some time for you. I'll get better thought for next week.
Frank, that was very good.
Yes,
thank
sir.
You. And,
Fred.
Hey, listen, next week, I'm going to be focusing on prison. You know, this is a fifth Thursday show, you know, and it's kind of, you know, a little bit different from the rest of the times. You know, we don't have the regularly scheduled guests. And I have my first half hour segment is going to feature Canon Patero Sabuni, who for many years was a chaplain at Sing Sing.
Mm.
And so I'm going to get some insight onto prisons from him. And I'm not quite sure how the rest of it's going to play out yet. I have invitations out that haven't been, I haven't got replies yet. But the whole show is going to pretty much focus on prisons. So... if you
great.
I
can do a whole gig
that.
on my experiences in the federal system.
That's
I'll even
exactly
go back and
what
look,
I was thinking.
What
I'll
go back and look what I said to the federal judges a couple years ago when I had a chance at them, and then I just review what I said to these judges in August of 2014.
Sounds
how's that sound?
Great. Sounds great, Frank.
Some of my best stuff.
All right.
Thank you. All right. All right, buddy. All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Sure. Bye-bye.
I always enjoy visiting with Frank. Got to meet him three years ago now. At the same trip when I got to meet in person my former co-host, Mike Palachuk. That was a good trip. Really good to put faces to the voices. All right. Well, we have one more guest for the evening. And this one I have not met in person because I have not managed to get myself over to Yaoundé, Cameroon. And that's where Julius Awafong lives. He joins us each month. And let's pull in the recording that he made for us and see what he has to say. Here we go.
Hello, Chok. Good evening and greetings to our listeners. Happy New Year 2020. And I want to wish each and every one of us a prosperous New Year. A peaceful new year, a new year full of health, and why not financial breakthrough, you know. Times are so hard this time around, and I believe the way forward will be for us to have some financial breakthroughs so we can easily manage our lives and fulfill our dreams. Something has been ticking in my mind since I defended my dissertation last month on the conflict within political parties in Cameroon and impact on elections or electoral behavior and electoral outcome. So I've been thinking about a PhD topic which I could carry out the research on for the next coming 4 years, even though I'm still trying to apply in a university around, maybe on scholarship too, because a research at the level of a PhD on the political sociology / political communication needs that we have a lot of money. We cannot carry out a good research. During my research on conflict within political parties, which is not only peculiar to Cameroon, which is the same thing in most sub-Saharan African countries. You can talk of Nigeria, you can talk of Kenya, you can talk of Gabon, you can talk of Zimbabwe, Uganda, Botswana, Burundi, Senegal, Mali, and the rest, you know. These are all post-colonial states, and most of these states are what we call multi-ethnic states. As I've been saying before, these are states that were in multiple ethnic groups with different cultures were forced to belong to a state. I mean, they were forced without even taking consideration of the disparity in their cultures, the differences in their tradition, their societal stratification or not being stratified. So suddenly we have states where which political scientists call multi-ethnic states. You can take Gabon, you can take Kenya, Cameroon, Nigeria, all these states are multi-ethnic states. And I discovered, as I said before, last time, that one of the main causes of conflict, political conflict, within most African states sub of the Sahara, is due to the fact that we have states that have multiple ethnic groups with a lot of differences in cultures. And what am I trying to say? I'm trying to find out how this disparity in culture, how did these differences in different cultures from different ethnic groups creates a form of communication that brings conflict. For example, if we take the case of Kenya, for example, we have the Kikuyu, we have the Luo, and so many other ethnic groups with different ways of doing things. Politically, how do they behave when they are in a state of Kenya? You'll find out that the way an ethnic group communicate is it reflects their culture. And sometimes the other group that has a culture different from the other ethnic group might think that the other ethnic group in its ways of communicating provokes conflict, or might think that they willfully do it to provoke them. Let me give examples. Let me come to the case of Cameroon. We have, for example, the stratified societies of Cameroon, and also have the stateless societies, what anthropologists call the acephalous societies. When a society is structured, those who live those who live in this structured society have a way of behaving, and this way of behaving affects how they communicate. And sometimes what they believe in, what they have internalized in them, shapes their communication so much so that their way of communicating so much so that it contradicts the norms of a modern imported state. Consequently, we have a situation where we are in a state, in an African state, where we have norms. These norms, which are put in place by the state to guide the functioning of the state, is imported most of the times. These norms don't embrace the socio-anthropological realities of the people. Now, if we take a case of the case of Kenya, for example, where we have six major ethnic groups, then we have a national norm, which is generally imported from the British style, because Britain colonized Kenya. Now, this British imported style of governance, of communication, of treating the people according to the nation of patriotism in the state, contradicts what the Luo community thinks, contradicts what the Kikuyu community thinks. And the Kikuyu's way of behaving, of treating one another in their societal setup, is different from that of the Luo. So you have, first of all, a conflict between the culture of the Luo and that of the Kikuyu, and a conflict between the socio-anthropological behavior of each of these groups with the imported norms. So to me, with all this, we are forced to enter into a vicious circle of conflict, a cyclical conflict that is so hard to find an end. Because it is very difficult to uniformize cultures in Africa. There's no African culture. There are African cultures, even though sometimes some people tend to look at Africa as one. Yes, there is Africa. And inside Africa, we have many ethnic groups with different and differing cultures. These differences, if not well managed, will always be conflictual. I mean, we always put the community, put the country, put the state in perpetual conflict. But how do we manage it? That's the question. Some people say we have to embrace the notion of patriotism. Yes, that is what they say. But what is being practiced is different. I will even take those in government. Let me take the case of Cameroon. The president of Cameroon coordinates or rules over Cameroon, and he is supposed to go by the constitution and the laws of the land. Now, Cameroon is made up of so many ethnic groups. Let me even start with the first president of Cameroon after the French and the English part of Cameroon unified in 1961. The first president was Ahmadou Ahidjo. Ahmadou Ahidjo was from the north, the Fulanis, the Fulbes, the Peuls. When he was in power, most of those who were recruited into the government apparatus came from his region, were mostly northerners. I mean, the Hausas, the Peuls, and all those who come from the northern regions close to the Muslim religion were in power. When he was removed from power and Paul Biya took over, Paul Biya is from the equatorial forest region. Ahidjo was from the north, the Sahara, the desertic regions of Cameroon, going up to Chad and northern Nigeria. That was his region. That's where the Peuls live in majority. Now, when power changed hands in 1982 from Ahidjo to Paul Biya, Paul Biya comes from an ethnic group that is found in the equatorial forest of Africa, that is south of Cameroon, Equatorial Guinea, and Chad. When he took over power, most of those who were put into government and who are still in government, I can even say 80% without exaggerating, come from his ethnic group. Now, there's a system where whenever somebody from an ethnic group takes over power in Cameroon, he drags people from his community to take over power. I mean, to manage most government offices. And this is the same thing in Nigeria. This is the same thing in Kenya and most other African cities, and even Cameroon. That is why in Cameroon, there's one guy from the ethnic group of Orbia wrote a book called The Paradox des Pays Organisateurs, The Paradox of the Governing Country. By the governing country, he meant the governing ethnic group. Even though he was trying to show that, even though most of those who manage the government institutions and the government business structures in Cameroon come from the ethnic group from which, I mean, to which the president of Cameroon belongs, these guys actually do nothing to the well-being of their own community or their own villages where they come from. So in the end, it's an ethnic power in Africa is very ethnic. But at the same time, an ethnicity that does not even cater for the well-being of the people who belong to the community of those who rule the country. Thank you, Chuck. Thank you, Chuck. And I forgot Mike is no more there. My time is up, and I'll be back next week for more updates. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you, Julius. Thanks to all the guests, and thanks especially to all of you listeners. I really appreciate you joining me right here on the New American Dream Radio Show at freedomslips.com. And remember, it is listener-supported radio. So, hey, you're a listener. Show them some support. Thank you. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.